Bhagwan, from this morning's insights on science and mysticism, these words of D.H. Lawrence, it is easy to see why man kills the thing he loves. To know a living thing is to kill it. One should be sufficiently intelligent and interested to know a good deal about any person one comes in close contact with, about her, about him, but to try to know any living being is to suck the life out of that thing. Above all things, with the woman one loves, every sacred instinct teaches one that one must leave her unknown. You know your woman darkly in the blood. To try to know her mentally is to kill her. Beware, O woman, of the man who wants to find out what you are. And, O man, beware 1,000 times more the woman who wants to know you or get you what you are. Man does so horribly want to master the secret of life and of individuality with his mind. Keep knowledge for the world of matter, force and function. It has got nothing to do with the being. And again, love ought not to be perfect. It ought to have perfect moments and wildernesses of thorn bushes, which it has. A perfect relationship ought not to be possible. Every relationship should have its absolute limits, essential to the soul of each individual. A truly perfect relationship is one in which each party leaves great tracts of the other unknown. Is not this also a description of a poet, a mystic? Ah, Bhagwan, there comes a glimpse of your mysterious, mischievous smile. You never stop your loving embrace with life. Anand Jerry I love these two men immensely. Friedrich Nietzsche and D.H. Lawrence both had the capacity to become enlightened masters, but both missed. Still, they had glimpses of great insight. D.H. Lawrence is a great poet and has something of the mystic in him too. But the only unfortunate thing is that he never became interested into meditation as such. He never tried to seek and search his innermost core. And he was very close to it. So close that even not knowing about it, something of it has penetrated into his words. Both these insights are tremendously true. To know a thing certainly means to reduce it into something dead. Life as such is intrinsically mysterious. It cannot be known the way physics knows. It can be known only the way poetry knows. The poet also knows about the rose flower, but his knowing is absolutely different from the knowing of a chemist, of a biologist, of a physicist. If the physicist tries to know the rose flower, he will think in terms of electrons, neutrons, positrons. If the chemist tries to know about the rose flower, then the rose flower is nothing but chemistry, chemicals. The poet does not look at the rose flower in terms of physics or chemistry. In fact, he does not observe the rose flower the way a scientist observes a thing. The scientist remains aloof, detached. He does not enter into the experiment himself. He is just a watcher. He simply takes notes what is happening. But the poet becomes a participant. In the world of poetry, knowing happens not through detachment, but through sympathy. Or, it will be even better if we use the word empathy. Empathy is the highest peak of sympathy. In sympathy, you feel how the other is feeling. The other is in pain, in misery, sad, or joyous. You feel it. Your heart gets in tune with the other. That is sympathy. It is a kind of symphony. But in empathy, you become one with the other. It is not only a question of getting in tune. It is merger. It is melting. The real poet melts into the rose. The observer and the observed become one. They are no more separate. There is not the poet standing aloof, away from the rose. There is no rose flower separate from the poet. They have merged into a deep dance. The poet is the rose flower. The rose flower has become the poet. There is no distinction left. They have trespassed each other. Then a totally different kind of knowing happens. That knowing cannot be called knowledge. Science is knowledge. The very word science means knowledge. But poetry is not knowledge. Of course, it is a kind of knowing. But so different, so qualitatively different, that even to call it knowing looks a little unjustified. but we don't have any other words. In Sanskrit, we have a word. Knowledge is called Gyan, and knowing is called Pragyan. In English, we can say that knowing is experiencing. Not experience, mind you, but experiencing. It is a deep merger. When the poet comes back to himself, he has brought a beautiful diamond. Vincent van Gogh has painted trees which reach above the stars. Now nobody has ever seen such trees. Such trees don't exist. But when he was asked, he said, "That's how I feel. Whenever I become one with a tree, I feel the ambition of the whole earth to reach beyond the stars in the every fiber of the tree. I have felt it. I have experienced it. And not once, but without any exception, always, whenever I see a beautiful tree and I become one with it, I feel the urge of the earth to transcend the stars. My paintings are paintings of that immense urge, that longing, that thirst of the earth." Of course, scientists cannot know anything about it. Tennyson has said that if I can understand a single flower in its totality, then I would have known the whole existence. Because a single flower contains the whole universe. The whole universe has joined hands together to create this single flower. This flower does not exist as an independent unit. It exists as an expression of the whole universe. The poet merges with the whole universe, and he reaches the flower in this subjective way. He knows an inner way, a secret path. His approach is intuitive. The scientist observes everything as an object. The word object has to be understood. Object means that it stands as an obstruction. It is like a wall confronting you. It has to be conquered. That's why science speaks in terms of conquering the world. Even a man like Bertrand Russell wrote a book, Conquest of Nature. The poet can never speak about the conquest. There is no question. Because there is no conqueror and nothing to be conquered. All is one, one organic unity. But the poet knows these moments only once in a while. D.H. Lawrence is a poet and has the quality of a mystic, but only once in a while. Otherwise, he was very intellectual, very argumentative. Even Bertrand Russell was very much irritated by him. Bertrand Russell himself was one of the greatest intellectuals of this age. But the way D.H. Lawrence argued was made him angry. He was very argumentative, very much in the head, but once in a while he slipped out of the head, and then there were great insights. This must have been such an insight. It is easy, he says, to see why man kills the thing he loves. Because when you love someone, some deep instinct in you starts hankering to know the person. And remember, knowledge is always an effort to conquer, to purchase. Because you want to purchase the person you love, you want to know all the secrets, because that is the only way to purchase. If something remains unknown of the person, that unknown part is not in your possession. That's why husbands and wives and lovers go on detecting on each other. They want to know everything. They go on goading each other to open your heart. Say it, whatsoever it is, bring it out. That is really ugly, because you may be able to know a little more about the person, but at the same time love is dying, because love can exist only between two mysterious persons who are mysteries to each other. It is easy to see why man kills the thing he loves. To know a living thing is to kill it. If you really want to know, you have to dissect. If the chemist wants to know the rose, he has to dissect it. He has to reduce it to the basic elements from where it has arisen. The earth has to be put separate. Every chemical has to be separated. The water has to be separated. Only then he will be able to know it. He has to decompose it so that he can know how it was composed in the first place. The poet does not even touch the flower. There is no question of dissection, analysis. He simply loves. He can dance around it. He can sing a song to the rose. He can put his cheek close to it. Sometimes he may even close his eyes while looking at the rose. That will be impossible for the scientist to understand what is going on. If you want to know the rose, you have to keep your eyes open. But the poet's way is totally different. It is not the way of knowledge. It is the way of love. And love enhances life just as knowledge kills it. One should be sufficiently intelligent and interested to know a good deal about any person one comes in close contact with. It is not meant that you should not be acquainted with the person. If you want to live with a person, you have to be acquainted. But acquaintance is totally different. Acquaintance is a must of every relationship. About her, about him. But to try to know any living being is to suck the life out of that being. Never try to know. Never try to penetrate the ultimate secret of the person. Leave it free. Love gives freedom. It is not a question of conquering. And the more freedom you give, the more knowing happens, but it is not knowledge. It is a feeling. It is intuitive. Above all things, with the woman one loves, because the woman is far more mysterious than the man. In fact, the most mysterious phenomenon in the whole existence, and very delicate, very fragile. Love is always very fragile. Handle it with care. Every sacred instinct teaches one that one must leave her unknown. Never try to know the woman you love, because the moment you start the effort to know her, you have already started destroying her. Soon she will be reduced into a wife, but then she is not the woman you had loved in the first place. The mystery has disappeared, and you are the cause of it. You know your woman darkly, in the blood, in the bones, in the marrow. To try to know her mentally is to kill her. Beware, O woman, of the man who wants to find out what you are. And O man, beware 1,000 times more the woman who wants to know you or get you what you are. Why 1,000 times more? Because the woman's way of knowing is far deeper than the man's way of knowing. Man's way of knowing is scientific and superficial, objective. Woman's way of knowing is intuitive, subjective. She can penetrate to the deeper realms of the man, and that's why she is capable of killing more easily the love than the man is capable of. Hence a deep fear in every man of the woman he loves. A certain intuitive feeling that the woman represents not only life but death also. In the East, particularly in India, we have the image of Goddess Kali, the Mother Goddess Kali. She is both a great lover and a great destroyer. If you have seen the image or any picture, you will be puzzled, particularly people coming from the West are very much puzzled, but it has a great psychological insight in it. Kali is dancing on the chest of her lover, Shiva. In Sanskrit, Shiva means one aspect of God, and Shava, just a little difference of spelling. Shiva means God, Shava means corpse. She is dancing on the chest of Shiva, destroying him into a corpse. Shiva is becoming a Shava. And she is having a garland of human skulls around her neck. In one hand, she is having a freshly cut head, blood coming out from it. Why this strange image? It is not strange. It is tremendously psychological. Woman has great powers because she is intuitive. Hence, Lawrence is right when he says, beware 1,000 times more the woman who wants to know you or get you what you are. Because you may know or may try to know the woman, but your effort is going to remain superficial. But if she starts penetrating you, she can reach to the very core. It is not surprising why almost all the husbands become henpecked. The woman reduces them into slaves. Man does so horribly want to master the secret of life and of individuality with his mind, keep knowledge for the world of matters, force and function. It has got nothing to do with being. And the second insight is also of tremendous importance. Love ought not to be perfect, because the moment anything is perfect, it dies. Perfection means death. It ought to have perfect moments and wildernesses of thorn bushes, which it has. A perfect relationship ought not to be possible, because once a relationship is perfect, nothing is left. Nothing is left to explore. All mystery is gone, evaporated. Every relationship should have its absolute limits. Essential to the soul of each individual, a truly perfect relationship is one in which each party leaves great tracts of the other unknown. Jerry, to give freedom is the most essential part of love. To make the other absolutely free is the ultimate of love. And only those who give freedom know what love is. And only those who love know what freedom is. Bhagwan, how can I conquer greed, anger, sex, the three great temptations of the devil, Virendra? It has been one of the obsessions of the Indians for centuries. And the only result of it all has been that they are the most greedy people on the earth, and the most angry, and the most sexual. For centuries they have been fighting against these three: greed, anger, sex. And what is the outcome? Do you see so much greed in anyone else on the earth, anywhere? Indians go on calling the Western people materialists. Without ever seeing the fact that to possess is not to be a materialist, but the desire to possess is the foundation of materialism. The West possesses, that does not mean that it is materialist. It simply means it is scientific, it is technological. It knows how to create things. It has penetrated deeply into the world of the objects and has come to know its secrets. It has worked hard. It is not materialist. It is simply technologically more developed. But Indians have great desire to possess. You may not have anything and still you will be a materialist if the desire to possess is there. You may possess only a small hut or only a begging bowl, and that is enough. And your whole possessiveness can be focused on it. And you will be a materialist, not a spiritualist. Materialism has nothing to do with greed. Materialism is a way of living your life just as spiritualism is. If you are constantly thinking of things and there is nothing more in your being, no desire for anything more, then you have chosen materialism as your way of life. Here you see people from all the countries, and the question is asked again and again by the Indians, why there are so few Indians? There are so few Indians because only very few Indians are interested in spiritualism as a way of life. Yes, they can talk about it. They can brag about it. It fulfills their ego, but they are not really ready to live it. Even if they come here, they come with the specific purpose that I can help them to go to the West, throw some Western sannyasins, to be educated in Cambridge, in Oxford, in Harvard, so that they can become capable of earning more. So many letters come to me that you have so many disciples all over the world. Can't you help us poor Indians to get scholarships, some support from foundations like Ford Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation? Their whole interest is how to possess more power, more things, more money, more prestige. They are not interested in meditation at all. And what is the reason? What has happened? What has gone wrong? 5,000 years they have been thinking of fighting with greed, anger, sex, And the total result is that the Indian mind is absolutely full of sexuality. They talk about spirituality. But if you look in their minds, if we can make small windows in Indian minds, you will be surprised. In their films, even kissing is not allowed. The government even decides how closer the lips of the lovers can come, 6 inches. More than that is obscene. And if you make small windows in Indian minds, you will see such obscene scenes that all your Playboy magazines will be nothing compared to them. And this is proved by the whole history of India. The first book on sexual postures was written by Indians, Vatsayana's Kama Sutras. Very obscene, ugly. Then the second book also was written by a Kashmiri Brahmin scholar, Pandit Kok, Kok Sastra. I sometimes suspect he may be the discoverer of Coca-Cola too. His name is Coca. His book is one of the dirtiest in the whole world. And you can go to see Khajuraho, Konark and Puri, and there are many other temples like them. And you cannot even imagine, even your fantasy will fail when you will see the sculpture of Khajuraho. What imagination! And for hundreds of years they must have worked, thousands of sculptors must have worked to create so many temples. It is a whole city of temples, only temples, because now the city is deserted. Hundreds of temples have disappeared, but still, hundreds of temples are still intact. Few are absolutely intact. You think group sex is something discovered by the Americans? You are wrong. On Khajuraho temples, there are scenes of group sex. You cannot imagine Khajuraho socks everybody. The woman is standing on her head and the man is making love to her. Headstand love. The man is standing on his head and the woman is making love to him. All kinds of obscene, stupid, silly ideas. And India is a spiritual country. And anger you can see every day in communal riots. Everywhere people are ready to kill so easily. Just a moment before they were praying, they were doing their namaz, they were doing their prayer. But very strange. that people go to do namaz with weapons, because immediately after the namaz, the killing starts, as if they were ready. The Hindus go to the temples and with the weapons. And all the political leaders of India go on talking of non-violence. And all these murders, killings, riots, houses are being burned, post offices are being burned, police stations are being burned, people alive are being burned. There are so many rapes all over the country. And still the leaders go on talking about non-violence, and the miracle of miracles is that all these things are provoked and managed by the opposite parties. All these communal rights are being done, inspired, triggered by the same people who had come to rule with Morarji Desai for 3 years. The same people, the same communalists, the same Hindu chauvinists are behind the whole scene, because they have tasted once the joys of power. Now they cannot remain powerless. Now by any means they have to reach to the power. First they will create in the whole country a state of chaos. And of course, if the government cannot control the chaos, the government is impotent. And there are only two alternatives left for the government. One alternative is just stand by the side and watch, because it is a democracy and everybody has the freedom of expression. And in India, people have only these repressed things: anger, violence, greed, sex. The moment a riot happens, immediately there are rapes. Immediately, shops are looted. Immediately, these things start happening. All three things together. This seems to be the innermost trinity in Indian mind: sex, anger, greed. They all come simultaneously. And the whole thing is managed by the opposite parties. So they have left only two alternatives for Indira Gandhi. One is, don't do anything. Just watch. Try to manage somehow, which they will make impossible. The second thing is, be strict. Impose something like emergency again. Then they will say, look, we have been telling that if you bring this woman back to the power, she will bring emergency immediately. Democracy will be destroyed. Had we not said that bringing Indira Gandhi back to power means the end of democracy, look. Now these two alternatives are left for Indira Gandhi. There is no other alternative. And this is how they are hoping to come back to power. If you stand without doing anything, then the chaos will make it absolutely clear to the country that the government is impotent, that it cannot do anything, it has to be changed. Or if you do something, that means you are destroying democracy. You are taking people's freedom away. And that is enough cause to pull you down from the power. My own suggestion to Indira Gandhi is impose a strict emergency than before. And for 15 years, no elections in this country. For 15 years, this country needs no democracy. This country is not capable of having democracy. It has not that much intelligence. It has lived for 2000 years in slavery. It only knows how to live peacefully in slavery. If it is freedom, it does not know how to cope with it. And in those 15 years, try forcibly to teach this country how to live independently. Nobody has taught this country how to live independently. And you are asking me, these are the three great temptations of devil, how to conquer them? This is the question Indians have been asking Virendra for 5,000 years. And the result is a total anarchy. I cannot suggest you any method to conquer because there is none. Understanding is possible. Victory is not possible. Through understanding, victory also is possible. But trying to be victorious, even understanding becomes impossible. And the more you try to escape from these temptations of devil, the more you will be in their grip. Because every temptation becomes more appealing the farther you escape from it. A beautiful woman went to see an old and experienced doctor. During the examination, he noticed two strange greenish spots on the inside of her thighs. And he asked, "Are you married?" "Engaged," replied the woman. "What is your fancy's profession?" "Well, doctor, he does not really have a profession. He is a gypsy." "A real one?" "Yes, doctor, a real gypsy." "Look, lady," said the doctor, "he may be real, but his earrings are not." For 5,000 years, you have practiced a religion which is false. The outcome shows absolutely clearly. And still you are asking the same question. A woman returns from a shopping trip wearing a very chic new dress. Her husband, appalled at the cost of the dress, tells her angrily that they cannot afford to spend money that way. "Well," says his wife, "I am afraid the devil tempted me." "Don't you know," fumes the husband, "that when the devil tempts you, you are supposed to say, 'Get thee behind me.'" "Yes," she replies, "I did that." But then he said, "My dear, it fits you so beautifully at the back." No old strategies will help anymore. It is better to go through all these experiences of greed, anger, and sex. Don't be a coward, Virendra. Your name means courageous, brave. And what you are asking is cowardly. Go through these experiences. Accept them as part of life. As God-given gifts, there must be something in them. There is. If you go through greed, searing arises. If you go through anger totally, in deep awareness, meditativeness, love arises, compassion arises. If you go through sex consciously, meditatively, you will have the first glimpses of samadhi. You will know the first windows opening into the divine. The old man is showing his son the family album. The boy sees a photograph where his father is sitting in a chair with his legs crossed while his mother is standing by his side with a pained expression on her face. "Hey, Dad, what is this?" asks the son. "What, son?" "This photo," says the boy. "Why are you making mother stand while you are sitting down? That is not being a gentleman." "Ah, son," explains the father, "this photograph was taken on our honeymoon. At that time your mother could not sit down and I could not stand up." Virendra, you need experience. You need understanding. And through understanding is transformation. Enough for today.